This is a reading from Ruth, chapter 4, which is in on page 257 of the Church Bible. If anybody wants a copy of the Church Bible, please put up your hand and a member of the hospitality team will give you a copy. Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there, just as the family guardian he had mentioned came along. Boaz said, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, "Sit here," and they did so. Then he said to the family guardian, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line." "I will redeem it," he said. Then Boaz said, "On the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property." At this, the family guardian said, "Then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it." Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the family guardian said to Boaz, "Buy it yourself," and he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth, the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today you are witnesses." Then the elders and all the people at the gate said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a family guardian. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This then is the family of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Aminadab. Aminadab, the father of Nashon. Nashon, the father of Salom. Salom, the father of Boaz. Boaz, the father of Obed. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David.
Brilliant. Why don't we applaud Alberta, because that was quite a reading, wasn't it?
Fantastic. Fantastic. Shall we pray? Father, thank you for your word. It is a lamp to our feet and a light to our path. And may it be so today. Amen. Now, I've entitled this sermon, Quiet Lives Count. Ordinary lives. Ruth is a really unusual book. This is the fourth in our series on Ruth, the final bit of Ruth. And Ruth, as a book, involves just one family. And seemingly, at the time, not a particularly significant family at that. Last week, we had Adrian preaching. If you missed that, pick it up on the downloads from the website, because it was an absolutely fantastic sermon. And he likened Naomi's family, where Ruth married into Naomi's family, as like the Joneses of the Bible. You know, they're just really ordinary people. You know, the people next door, modest, nondescript, ordinary family. We are used to today about hearing of great world events. You know, today is the 50th anniversary of Neil Armstrong stepping foot onto the moon. You know, it's an epic, world-changing event. We hear of this week a new prime minister of the UK. Good Lord, deliver us. Anyway, big events, big people, important people. And here in Ruth, we just have an ordinary family. We've just had the book of Judges. The book of Judges and the book of Ruth are like twins. But they're not similar twins, because the book of Judges is a book about epic events, about world leaders, about wars, significant people on the national stage. And Ruth is about one quiet little family living in a backwater. There is no Samson. There is no Gideon. There is no Deborah. There are no great victories that we read about in Judges, all happening at the same time. They're not even referred to. It's just about a quiet little family. You can look at a story like this in two ways. You can look at it up close, through a microscope, at all the details of this family. But then at some stage, you need to stand back from it and see Ruth in the big picture. And that's what we're going to do today. So we look at this little family story with all its ups and downs. And we're going to focus in close. It's just a little story. And then later on, we will look at it in the context of the great sweep of history and see something incredibly significant happening through this nondescript family. So what is Ruth about? Now, usually in the Bible, we discover what a passage in the Bible is about because the passage will say what it's about, either right at the beginning of the passage or right at the end. So, you know, you come to Genesis 1. Genesis 1 starts, "In the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth." What is Genesis 1 about? Oh, it's about God making the heavens and the earth in the beginning. You know, it tells you. So at the beginning of Luke, you've got Luke says, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those from whom were first eyewitnesses. And with this in mind, I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning. I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent philosophers." So there, here is Luke saying at the beginning of his book, "This is what my book is about." Sometimes in the Bible, you get a passage where it tells you what the book or the section is about right at the end. And so near the end of John's Gospel, In John 20, John says, Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you might believe in Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So there is John giving us the reason for writing his book really near the end of his book. So the reason often comes either at the beginning or at the end. And in Ruth, it comes at the end. The reason for the book comes at the end. And I will read you the reason of the book for the book. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron was the father of Ram. Ram was the father of Amminadab. Amminadab was the father of Nahshon. Nahshon was the father of Salmon. Salmon was the father of Boaz. Boaz was the father of Obed. And Obed was the father of Jesse. And Jesse was the father of David. That's the reason for the book. Ruth is one of two books in the Bible where a genealogy is the main purpose of the book. The other book is actually called a genealogy. It's in the title. Do you know what that book is? There is a book in the New Testament which is called The Genealogy of Jesus the Messiah. We call it Matthew. That's what the title of the book is. Ruth is the other book where if the writer of Ruth probably was Samuel, if the writer of the book had picked a title, he would have said, The Genealogy of David. That's what he would entitle the book, I think. It's The Genealogy of David. That's the point of the book. Now, you may find that boring, but it's not. Trust me, it's not. We're going to park that for a moment, but I'll come back to that. Let's just review what's happened. It was really important this morning that we had a lawyer read our Bible reading because it was a strange legal thing that was happening in chapter 4. But let's just review what's happened in the second half of Ruth. Chapter 3, which Adrian preached on last week, we have Ruth. She went to lie at Boaz's feet on the threshing floor. Boaz is referred to as a kinsman redeemer or a family redeemer of Elimelech and Naomi's family. And when he discovers that Ruth is lying at his feet, he immediately knows what it's about and he appears to be pleased about it. And Adrian unpacked that and was brilliant last week. Then in chapter 4, we have Boaz concluding a property transaction at the town gate involving the taking off of sandals. And the result is Boaz marries Ruth. All clear, is it? I mean, these things are really peculiar to our ears, aren't they? Because this is from an ancient culture which is so different. And so we do need to know a few things about their ancient culture. Now, some of which Adrian covered last week. And do listen to that. But I'm going to go over it again just so that we know what's going on. In the society of ancient Israel, they had a mechanism for ensuring that the rich-poor divide didn't run out of control. Now, all modern societies or civilized modern societies try to moderate the rich-poor divide, don't we? You know, we have social services, we have social security benefits, and we have a graduated taxation in order to try and avoid the rich becoming runaway rich and the poor becoming absolutely destitute, because we want a society where we all live together peaceably and there's some degree of equality. We obviously want to reward endeavour, but we also want to look after the underdog. So there's some kind of equity in that. And Britain is not the best at doing this, but we're a lot better than many other societies. We're a long way from being the worst. In any society, you get those who do very well for themselves. And you also get those who go the other way. They fall on hard times, either because they've made poor choices or that they've just got unlucky. And I think most of us who have done really well would want to not get so far ahead of those who have fallen on harder times that society becomes completely divided. We don't want to live in a society like that. So we try to moderate the difference between the haves and the have-nots, don't we? And that's right and proper. And ancient Israel had a way of levelling that playing field. And it was called the Year of Jubilee. It happened once every 50 years. And once every 50 years, all the debts of the people who had not done so well were cancelled. And more significantly than that, all the land that the people who had really got themselves into trouble and they'd flogged off the land, their family land was returned to them, to the original family, after 50 years. Now, the concept of ancestral land is really strange to our ears. And that's because we do not live in a rural agricultural economy. So the whole thing breaks down if you have an urbanized society. But for some of us, and I think certainly, you know, when I've traveled in Africa, particularly in Kenya, if you speak to a Kenyan, they will know where their family comes from. One of their relatives will have some ancestral lands back where they come from. Now, that system is beginning to break down as Kenya, like many places, becomes urbanized. But it still persists even to this day. And that's what it was like for ancient Israel. Everybody, each family had an ancestral land. And in order to keep their ancestral land, they needed a male heir. So Naomi's husband, Elimelech, he had ancestral lands. He had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and they had all died. Elimelech had died, Mahlon and Chilion had died, so where would the ancestral lands be returned to at the year of Jubilee for the heritage of Elimelech's line to be preserved? It was a big problem for Naomi. There was no male heir in order for the year of Jubilee system to work. And Naomi was one of the have-nots. Their family had done badly. All their lands had been sold off. And now this was a really big problem. So big that Naomi, and the name Naomi means sweet. I have a daughter called Naomi. She was so sweet when she was born that we called her sweet. We called her Naomi. She's still sweet. Naomi, the name means sweet. And Naomi says, no, I want to be called Mara, which means bitter. This is the original bittersweet story. Now, another practice that we need to know about from ancient Israel, we've had the year of Jubilee. The other practice is a thing called Levirate marriage, as prescribed in Deuteronomy 25. Levirate marriage was the system designed to help someone in exactly Naomi's position, where her husband and her sons had died and they needed a male heir. And so when a man died, leaving a widow, they've not had children, especially not had a male heir so that they could inherit the ancestral lands, honor dictated that the next man in line in the family, presumably a brother usually, would marry the widow, and thereby the family line would be preserved. But Naomi's husband had died, and her two sons had died, and now Naomi was old. All she had was this daughter-in-law, Ruth. And then in the story, we discover that Boaz was a kinsman redeemer. He wasn't next in line, but he was next to next in line. In other words, he was a relative who potentially had obligations. Now, evidently, he wasn't a close relative. He wasn't a son of Elimelech. He was probably a cousin or something. If he'd been a close relative, the solution would have presented itself to him much more readily. But he was a kinsman redeemer, but he knew that he was not next in line. There was another one ahead of him, and we are assuming that that was Boaz's older brother, although he's not named. And then we have this transaction at the town gate, where the man who is next in line surrendered his right to the ancestral land, which goes with Levirate marriage, with Ruth. He surrenders his right, and Boaz is free to take the land and Ruth as his wife, and preserving Elimelech's line so that the ancestral lands can go with that family. And they transact the deal at the town gate where the elders sit. And it's done by the taking off of a sandal, another peculiar ancient Israel practice. Don't forget, this is a non-writing oral society. They did have writing, but writing was on clay. You know, it's really expensive. You didn't do it all that much. So it was largely an oral society. So things weren't written down, but they were legally transacted. They were witnessed. And I guess the taking off a sandal, the modern equivalent of this, is a signature. This is a witness signature. You take off that sandal, everybody witnesses it. This is the deal done. So there we have the story that Elimelech's relative, elder brother, whoever he was, surrenders his right. He takes off his sandal, gives it to Boaz, and Boaz is free to inherit the ancestral lands of Elimelech and take Ruth as his wife to preserve Elimelech's family line. The result is, of course, Boaz ends up marrying Ruth, the Moabitess. Incredible set of circumstances seemingly happening at random. It's a lovely story, isn't it? It's a lovely story where there are awful wars and troubles happening in the book of Judges simultaneous to this, just down the road in the area of Benjamin, the tribal area of Benjamin, literally maybe 3 or 4 miles away. There were wars happening in this area, in Bethlehem, the tribal lands of Judah. We have this lovely family story. No mention of these extraordinary political events, wars and great leaders and all sorts of seismic things happening just down the road. No mention of them. No Boris Johnson. No Donald Trump. No great tankers in the Gulf. No, one little family story with a happy ending. But of course, that's not the whole story, because that's the up close picture. We now need to stand back and see it in the context of history. And this is where it gets really exciting, because Ruth is about the genealogy of David. That Boaz was the father of Obed. Obed was the father of Jesse, and Jesse was the father of David. Now, in our society, we are not that hot on genealogies. Here's mine. So I'm ringed in red, and this goes, what, 6 or 7 generations of my genealogy, that Richard Kendall was the father of George Kendall, who is the father of Thomas Kendall, who is the father of Thomas Herbert Kendall, who is the father of Norman Kendall, who is the father of Norman Oliver Kendall, who is the father of Henry Kendall, who is the father of Oliver Kendall, who is the father of Juno Kendall. It's my genealogy. It's important to me. Maybe it's not important to you, because in our society we've become terribly individualistic. You know, as a society we are nothing like, in the UK, it's not true in many parts of the world, but in the UK we're not terribly family orientated. And yet in much of the world, your family is your identity. It's who you are. Your background, your upbringing. Whereas we say, you know, I want to be my own person. And there's good in that. But I think actually we need to be a little bit more connected than that. This Ruth story is an amazing family story. Through seemingly inconsequential events in a quiet backwater, away from the action, we have a heritage that would lead to David, the greatest king who would ever live, rule over Israel. And then through David, we know the bigger story still would lead to Jesus, the Messiah. So who was Ruth? Ruth, first, she was a Moabite. She was a hated foreigner. And secondly, she was a gleaner. Gleaners were beggars. They did the most menial of jobs. It was an equivalent of just picking up little scraps. They were almost entirely destitute. There is a famous painting called The Gleaners. This is it. It hangs in the Musée d'Orsay. It's by Jean-François Millet. And it scandalized the Salon in 1857, because here are the gleaners. They are the lowest of the low. You know, the important people are the guy on the horse up there and the proper workers. And here are the gleaners. They are nothing. They are the scum. And yet Millet has painted them with such sympathy and love. And society hated it because they wanted the underdogs kept down. Moabite, Ruth the Moabite, the gleaner, who came to live among a people who were not our own. The bottom of the bottom, the scum, the hated foreigner, became the great grandmother of David. And the ancestor of Jesus. You may not think that your life is particularly significant. You may not think that what you do has any great value. Maybe what you do is the equivalent of gleaning. It's just nothing. You do not know what God has for you. We're going to show a little video now of a chap called Nick Hills. Have you heard of Nick Hills? I bet you haven't. You may have seen this video before. I think it's really charming. Let's run the video.
I'm back in Cambridge. Back to the days where, obviously, I worked very hard, but I did spend a lot of time on the river, rowing.
I last coxed about 40 years ago. If you believe in prayer, I suggest you say one now.
Are you ready? Go!
Nick Hills and I were students together at Cambridge, and we recently met to visit the college we were both at. and take a tour.
Hi, Nick.
Hello, Justin.
Very nice to see you. I've had so long.
We headed over to Nick's room in 1 year when he was at the college. A transforming moment happened, a life-changing moment.
May I go in?
Yes,
here we go. Why don't you lead the way?
All right.
Because you used to live here.
Thank you very much for letting us disturb you. You're very kind.
We came back here, I think, about 10-ish.
On October the 12th, 1975, just before midnight, that having spent time talking and sharing, speaking together, and I realised that I was at a point of decision about life, and my life was going to go one of two ways. And I prayed a very simple prayer of saying, Lord Jesus, come into my life. I don't know anything about you, but come into my life. And he came in, something changed, and has stayed changed from then on, with all the ups and downs and me trying to run away and good times in the life, in my life, and really bad ones. And that started with you just as another undergraduate, very simply encouraging me to look at who Jesus was. I just can't imagine how different my life would have been. That's the extraordinary thing.
Well, the next morning you gave me this Bible.
You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. Cambridge, 1975. That was the verse that was the page that was open when I became Archbishop of Canterbury, when I was installed at Canterbury Cathedral in the St. Augustine copy of the Gospels that St. Augustine brought with him in 597. They said, do you want it open anywhere in particular? I said, yes, John 15, 16.
Right.
From that moment.
Isn't that
extraordinary?
Isn't that fantastic? Nick Hills, I bet you never heard of him. But without his faithfulness, his little quiet life, you would never have heard of Justin Welby. I guess we can all think of people who've had dramatic impact on our lives. And not all of them are the big superheroes, the Samsons of this world, the Boris Johnsons of this world. They're not, are they? They're often the quiet lives. Quiet lives count. Truth is, we rarely know the repercussions of incidents in our own lives. Seemingly inconsequential moments that ripple down the decades afterwards. We just never realised it. You know, as far as we know, Ruth did not live to know that her great-grandson was king of Israel. She had died by that time. Maybe you will never know the repercussions of your life down the ages. Paul says, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, nor the heart of man imagined what God has prepared for those who love him. What has God got for you? What has God going to do through you? What are the future generations going to say in years to come? We may never know. But do not think that your life doesn't count. The story of Ruth is a story of one quiet, insignificant family. But the ripples from that family change the world. None of us would be here but for Ruth. Isn't that extraordinary? Shall we stand? Father, we thank you that quiet lives count, our lives count, that amazingly within your abundant providence, you cause our lives to count. And we just want to surrender up to you all we are, whether we are a Moabite and a gleaner or a great mover and shaker. We are yours, and you can make our lives count.